Good morning, and welcome to The People's Business, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee, and a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. And we're going to try our best to cast a little sunshine on the ways in which government is doing and not doing the people's business. Later in today's program, we'll be speaking with businessman, high-tech entrepreneur, innovative political thinker, and activist Bill Samuels. But before we hear from Bill Samuels, we're pleased to be joined by past and likely future gubernatorial candidate Howie Hawkins of the Green Party. Howie, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
It's good to be here. Thank you.
This is Brian McDonnell, and I'd also like to welcome our guest, Howie Hawkins, to The People's Business here on WRPI Troy. A resident of Syracuse since 1991, Howie's involved in numerous community development and energy-efficient organizations, but he's best known throughout the state of New York for his 2010 run for governor. Before we talk about some of the issues that you're involved with, Howie, can you tell us a little bit about how and when and why you got involved with the Green Party?
I got involved in this kind of politics in the 60s as a teenager, coming out of the civil rights movement. I'm in a racially mixed neighborhood, extended family, cousins, whatnot, racially mixed. And so we were very aware of civil rights. And in 1964, the Mississippi Freedom Democrats were denied seating at the Democratic Convention. Ronald Reagan's campaigning against fair housing. They repealed the fair housing law in California. So I said, where's my party in 64, like John Lewis had said at the March on Washington? And by 67, we had a Peace and Freedom Party. Peace in Vietnam, freedom meant civil rights, and I've been involved in it ever since.
So when did the Green Party per se come into existence?
We had our first national meeting in St. Paul, Minnesota in August 1984, and we're actually having our 30th anniversary convention there this summer in St. Paul.
Hey, this is Ron Deutsch, and I also want to welcome you to our show today, The People's Business, here on WRPI in Troy. So I wanted to ask you, Howie, I know that, a lot of other third parties basically are endorsing other candidates in the Democratic or Republican Party, whether it's the Conservative Party or the Working Families Party. They tend not to run their own candidates. The Green Party definitely takes a different approach to this, which I have to say I admire, and that, you know, you're always running your own candidates and you don't kind of do this cross endorsement that so many others do. Why do you do that? Why not just do the simple cross endorsements and go for the, you know, the big vote get that many of the other groups do?
Well, we're going for the big vote. We're going for as many votes as we can, but we believe that nobody can speak for working people like us. You know, the other parties try to get the major parties, which are mainly funded by the 1% of the 1%, the very, very rich people, the billionaires and hundreds of millionaires, and then the people are out here trying to get them to say this or do that, and it doesn't work. When they sign on another line or run on another line, that party will say, vote for them on our line, and it'll send a message to the major party candidate. I think the message is, take us for granted because we're going to vote for you anyway. We run our own people and then compete for those votes, and that forces the major parties either adopt some of the programs that we're promoting that are popular or, you know, we'll get elected because, you know, we're promoting those programs. So that's our approach, independent politics. Nobody can speak for us, like us, you know, the regular working people.
In local elections, the Green Party candidates occasionally, but rarely, have actually won. It's probably hard to win at a state level. So what do you try to accomplish in a state-level campaign? You ran for governor in 2010, and you're likely to run for governor again. Given that your chances of winning are not great, you obviously are trying to impact the system in some other way as well.
Well, the governor's race in New York State is the way you get a permanent ballot line. So that's what we did in 2010. You need 50,000 votes. We got just short of 60,000. So our local candidates could then get on the ballot by getting the signatures of 5% of the Greens enrolled in the district in which they're running, as opposed to an independent nominating petition, which we have to do without a ballot line, which is much more difficult. And later in the election cycle, the party petitions are in June and July. the independent petitions are in July and August, and then if they contest you, you may not get confirmed on a ballot till about October 1. So it's just much better. And because of that, we have a couple of village mayors in New Paltz and Greenwich. We have town board members, a city council member in Ithaca. We do have local elected officials in New York, and across the country we have about 200. So we want to build on that. So that's the minimal objective. In this election, we want to get enough votes so that if we get 5%, 250,000 votes, which we think is within our reach, we will have gotten more than any independent left party in New York history. And then I think the media and the public will look to us when they want to know what the left is thinking on issues rather than a liberal Democrat or, you know, the second line for the Democrats, the Working Families Party. And I think that'll change the whole conversation and the dynamic of New York politics.
So you say the Green Party is a party of the working man, and I think you ably represent working New Yorkers all across the state, struggling families. Are you independently wealthy that you can run for governor, or what is it that you do?
I'm a teamster who unloads trucks at night at UPS. So, you know, there's this poll out there, unnamed working families candidate gets 24%. Well, I'm a working teamster with a name, Howie Hawkins. I think that poll was about me. That's why I think, you know, this year particularly, Cuomo has been very hard on the schools and on public services and with his budgets, and he's got a property tax proposal that really isn't relief. And that's got conservatives upstate as well as, you know, liberals and progressives and radicals around the state upset. So I think there's a real audience for what we're talking about.
So, Howie, tell us a little bit about your platform. I see you're wearing a button today that says $15 an hour. So I assume the economic justice is a part of your platform.
Yeah, the theme of our campaign is a Green New Deal for New York. And the New Deal part goes back to Roosevelt, 1944. He does a State of the Union address, calls for a second economic bill of rights to provide people with some basic rights, like the right to a job, to a living wage. $15 an hour is even less than the 1963 March on Washington asked for. They asked for a $2 minimum wage, which, if you adjust for inflation, is $15.44 right now. We believe in health care for all through a publicly funded single-payer plan. We want the schools fully funded. We want enough investment in housing and transit so it's affordable and convenient. And then the green part of the Green New Deal is we want to go for 100% clean energy by 2030. We want to ban fracking and go the renewable route. And that in itself is a full employment program. We have this study out from Mark Jacobson. He led a consortium of scientists, engineers, and economists, a lot of them from New York. And they said it's technically and economically feasible to have 100% wind, solar, water, energy, no carbon emissions by 2030. What's missing is the political will. But in that study, they said it would take 4.5 million jobs to build that system out over the next 15 years. Unemployment, 750,000 officially. You could double that if you count involuntarily part-time employers and, of employees, and also people that have not counted because they're discouraged and haven't looked in the last month. But that's still a lot more jobs than we have unemployed here. People will come to New York to help us build that system out. And then the question everybody says, well, how are you going to pay for it? And, you know, coming out of the 1963 March, which reiterated Roosevelt's demands, the March on Washington for jobs and freedom, put forward all these demands. And we've not made any progress since 70 years ago, Roosevelt, 51 years ago, the March on Washington. Coming out of that was a freedom budget that the organizers of the March on Washington. And our freedom budget basically says, let's go back to the 1970s tax structure we had in New York. It was more progressive on business and personal income taxes. We didn't have all this corporate welfare, and we kept instead of rebated the stock transfer tax. And, you know, we figure there's at least $30 billion more in revenue there. And most of us, working people, would get a tax cut. And the difference would be made up by the top 5% and particularly the top 1%. And that's how we can fund a Green New Deal for New York.
This is the People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with past and likely future gubernatorial candidate Howie Hawkins of the Green Party. His website is www.howiehawkins.org.
So, Howie, I wanted to ask you, you know, you've been rather critical of Governor Cuomo. The governor is, you know, trying to paint himself as more progressive, perhaps, than you would suggest he is. There was a lot of debate around tax policy in this year's budget, in particular things like the elimination of the dedicated bank tax, eliminating or increasing the thresholds on the state's estate tax and this property tax freeze, all of which you seem to disagree with. Read some of your press releases that you put out. So what do you think? Is the governor as progressive as he claims? Is he a social progressive or is he an economic progressive? What's your thoughts on that?
I think he's very conservative on his economic policies, and he's playing games with people. He says, I'm providing property tax relief, and he's touting tax cuts. But most of those tax cuts are the ones you mentioned, the bank tax cuts, the corporate rates, the zero rates for manufacturers, cuts in the estate taxes. He's still rebating 100% of the stock transfer tax. That's all for the 1%, the rich folks. What we get for ordinary people upstate in particular, they're really under a heavy burden of property taxes because the state does not share the revenues like they used to. Revenue sharing is a way to share some of the state revenues that we are paying to the state back to the municipalities and the schools, and let us locally decide how much of that to devote to property tax relief or restoring school and municipal services. And he doesn't provide revenue sharing. He's kept it at a flat rate. It's less than 1% of state revenues. The original revenue sharing law that was in the state finance law was 8% of state revenues. You know, everybody who lives in communities, just imagine your city or county or village or town budget, if you had 8 times the revenue sharing you're getting now, you would end all the fiscal distress we've got all over upstate. So, you know, he's imposing austerity on working people so he can give those tax cuts to the rich folks. And we're going to pay for it in cuts to our schools and property taxes. I was in Ithaca last week, and they are getting a big $7.31 on average in Tompkins County tax rebate check. The Ithaca School District is raising taxes, property taxes, 8%, and they're still going to have to lay off people and cut programs. That's what Governor Cuomo has been giving us.
Our guest, Howie Hawkins, lives in Syracuse, so the comments on revenue sharing are pretty important to his home base. I know you're a native of California. How did you select Syracuse as a place to settle in?
Well, I have been working construction, and it was 89, and there was a depression in construction, so I'm logging, and a tree almost rolled on me. I ended up rupturing a disc in my back, so I had to get a desk job. And I got a job organizing cooperatives in Syracuse, which enabled my back to heal, and then the funding ran out for that, so I went out to UPS and got the job unloading trucks.
What do you see as the economic future for Syracuse?
It's pretty dismal if we don't get revenue sharing back up. The mayor asked for $16 million for emergency repairs to infrastructure. On my block, we've had the gas main break the same week that they had an explosion in East Harlem. We've had the sewer back up into the building. We've had water main break, which we had 2 a day all winter. And the potholes are so big the kids can get lost in them. I mean, it's really falling apart up there. We've had a quarter of the staffing for our schools laid off in the last 4 years. And we're getting no relief from the governor. And our mayor, who was pretty much philosophically in agreement with Cuomo, called him out in the New York Times for not taking leadership. She wanted amendments to the labor laws so she could go after workers, public workers, employee health care and pension benefits. And she just said, Cuomo, I'm out here on a limb by myself. You got to lead. And he didn't like the fact that he was called out, so he just cut Syracuse off. And that seemed petty. And it's, you know, there's the Buffalo Billion, and Rochester got a little extra this year. We got nothing. And it just seems vindictive.
You're in Albany today for a number of events. You participated in some of the Earth Day events yesterday. Earth Day itself nationally was back in April, but New York State yesterday had a big Earth Day lobby day, and today is a big single-payer lobby day. Tell us about the single-payer issue in New York and what you guys at the lobby day are pushing for.
Well, single-payer health care, the state did a study at the request of the legislature back in 2009 and said by 2018 we would save, as New Yorkers, $28 billion a year on our health costs and cover everybody over this individual mandate system that we've got with the Affordable Care Act from the federal government. So single-payer would make a lot of sense. It would relieve municipal budgets because that would be taken off their budgets and funded through the state system. What we want to do this year is get the assembly to vote for the bill. There are 74 sponsors, I believe, at this point. That's one short of a majority.
Is the bill a study of single payer?
No,
or
this
something
is
more?
This is a bill for single payer.
This is the Gottfried bill.
The Gottfried bill. So we will be, you know, getting briefed this morning on that, and then we're going to go lobby the legislators, and you know, push Speaker Silver to let's have a vote. And you know, sometimes people sponsor bills, but when it comes time to vote, they don't really want to. We see this in California, when Governor Schwarzenegger was the governor. The Democratic legislature would pass single payer and then he'd veto it. Now they've got a Democratic governor majority and they don't vote on it, you know. So we want people to get off the fence and get on the record.
Howie, there's a history of minor parties in New York State, but most of the people you're going to be talking to generally are members of the Democratic Party, the Republican Party. So you've got an uphill battle to get your message out. So tell us a little bit about your campaign plan. Where are you going? Who are you talking to? And what kind of reception are you getting?
Well, I'm talking to everybody. I am meeting sometimes on the QT with Democratic clubs in the city, with organizations that traditionally support Democrats. There are members of the Democratic Party calling us. I have, you know, been active in this kind of politics for a long time. I've never seen a response like this. I think it's partly, you know, anger at Cuomo for being, you know, very conservative on the economic issues in particular. I think the Obama hope and change that, you know, hope has worn off, and people are wondering, you know, where are we at now? And so they're beginning to look at their options. I think the public employees and the teachers are really angry at the way they've been treated. Parents are upset with this high-stakes testing regime that's been imposed. So we're having trouble keeping up with the inquiries, how can we help and whatnot. So what we're doing is raising money. We hope to open 4 field offices and have an organizer in each one: New York City, Albany, Syracuse, and Western New York. That'll either be Rochester or Buffalo. And maybe even some more. When I was in Ithaca, somebody offered free space, and maybe we'll just have a volunteer operation out of there. So, you know, this is the biggest campaign we've ever had. And, you know, our challenge is to just keep up and be able to scale up to what's coming at us.
I was going to ask you, I got a kind of a two-part question. One would be, any thoughts on who your lieutenant governor would be? And then to follow up with that, what would the first day of the Howie Hawkins gubernatorial beginnings look like?
We will have an announcement either later this week or early next week of a candidate that I've talked to who I think will be, you know, a powerful addition to the ticket. And that's all I can say at this point, because we got to let the Greens hear it from us first rather than through the media.
Because you have a convention coming up. Say a little about your convention.
Yeah, May 17th in Troy, New York at the Sanctuary for Independent Media. We'll start at 9 in the morning and go till 6, and we will have, you know, nominating session, a platform session, workshops to train people how to organize locally, how to use our computerized platform for keeping all the information about our supporters and funders and whatnot. And then we'll have a rally after we've nominated and wrap it up by 6 or 6:30.
How are delegates to your conventions selected?
They are representatives of county organizations. They are elected by their county membership. And we have to, by state law, do a weighted vote based on the gubernatorial vote for the nominations. For the platform, any enrolled Green in the state can come and vote on the platform. So that's the plan for the convention.
Let's go back to Ron's question. I don't know if you're thinking this far ahead, but do you have plans for what you would do at the beginning of your administration?
Yeah, I was asked that when I announced, and first, I said I'll call Ralph Nader and Gar Alperovitz and people like that and say, get your Rolodex out. I got a staff in administration. Then I thought, you know, what I would do is convene the minimum wage board that the governor has the power to do. He's been asked by the legislature to do so for tipped workers. He has not. The law says he should. And get people on there and let's look at the minimum wage. I think it's $15 statewide, and then there should be a home rule for communities like New York City where the cost of living is very high, where it should be higher. I think the other thing I'd do is form this Truth, Justice, and Reconciliation Commission that Dr. Alice Green with the Center for Law and Justice in Albany has been calling for, to look at the impact of the war on drugs on the communities especially impacted, let them testify, and then figure out a way to repair the damages. And that was one of the things I was doing yesterday as well. We had a demonstration against the solitary confinement, but a lot of these criminal justice issues where we have a real disparity in the treatment of different communities that have to be addressed. So that'd be another thing I would do on day one. Form that commission. It's modeled after the Truth and Reconciliation Commission they did in South Africa that Mandela initiated to, you know, get past the apartheid era.
So,
let's have a last question from Ron Deutsch.
Okay, one of my favorites, and we've talked about this on the show before, and we've actually had Assemblyman Phil Steck on recently who has been pushing a bill on this. You bring up the stock transfer tax a lot. It's one of those kind of hidden items that we don't really talk about in New York State. It's a tax that's still on the books. Even though the legislature tried to remove it this past session, we were able to keep it
on the books. Well,
the governor proposed it. The Senate accepted it. The Assembly rejected it. And in the final budget, it still remains. So tell us a little bit about the stock transfer tax and why you'd like to see it reimposed.
Well, it's a tax of pennies per share per trade that, you know, traders used to pay. The tax was instituted in 1906, and they paid up until 1981. It's been 100% rebated. They actually pay it now, and it gets rebated right back to them. And it's generated between $12 and $16 billion in recent years because of this computerized high-frequency trading where these big firms jump in the front of the line and kind of skim some money off ahead of us retail investors. Or, you know, even if we don't have personal investments, we might have a pension fund that, you know, like my Teamsters pension fund that, you know, we're basically paying for that, I call it computerized insider trading. So the least they can do is pay a tax. We pay 7, 8, 9% sales tax on most things we buy. But, you know, the wealthy are, you know, doing all these trades and they're not paying anything. So it would be a good source of revenue for the state. And, you know, I appreciate the fact that the Assemblyman Steck has put the bill in to keep some of that revenue. And we were nervous because, you know, Governor Cuomo called it a nuisance tax. He just wanted to get rid of it. And another favor to the 1%. And one of the small victories we had is it's still there on the books, so we can maybe keep that tax.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy. And we've had the pleasure of speaking with past and likely future gubernatorial candidate Howie Hawkins of the Green Party. You can see information about Howie and his issues at www.howiehawkins.org. Howie, thank you very much for taking the time to speak with us this morning.
Well, thanks for having me.
We'll be back in a few minutes to continue The People's Business on WRPI Troy. And welcome back to The People's Business on WRPI Troy. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director Emeritus of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm pleased to be joined in the studio by Brian McDonnell, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers for Fiscal Fairness. Last month, one of our guests here on The People's Business was Saratoga Springs Mayor Joanne Yepsen, who detailed some of her concerns about the possible sighting in Saratoga Springs of a full-blown casino with table games. It looks like Mayor Yepsen's concerns on this front are over for the time being, since the Racino in Saratoga Springs is now focusing on East Greenbush as the location for a casino with table games rather than Saratoga Springs. What are your thoughts on the way the bidding for the first four upstate casinos is evolving?
Well, I think it's an interesting process. I was kind of surprised to see the folks from Saratoga Gaming and Raceway abandon their efforts in Saratoga and move down to a site in East Greenbush. I think they were certainly getting some resistance from the city council in Saratoga and from a lot of residents in Saratoga. So I think they saw the writing on the wall and decided to move further south with their, you know, Las Vegas style casino gaming. And I'm a little surprised, I guess, because Saratoga already has an active casino, a racino, if you will, with all electronic slot machines and electronic VLTs, the video lottery terminals. So I think, you know, some people were afraid that the introduction of these kind of table games would change the kind of, I don't know, gambling dynamic that's in Saratoga. But I don't know. I'm kind of surprised that Saratoga rejected it to a certain degree. I can't say I'm unhappy about it, but I was surprised to see it move down south.
Well, don't you think they realized in Saratoga that they've got a pretty good thing going and they didn't want to sort of upset the apple cart, right?
I do think that's part of the fear was also that, you know, the Racino expansion and with table games was going to draw business from downtown Saratoga. They were going to take business away from the city's convention center, that they would draw, you know, entertainment venues into their new amphitheater. So I think, you know, a lot of the concerns were founded, but I'm surprised that, you know, we had this many people putting up $1 million just to get a seat at the table last week.
So a, as the cynics would say, a full employment program for lawyers and lobbyists.
Yeah, it seems to be that way right now. I'm kind of surprised at the way this is moving in the Capital District. But it seems like there's two locations being looked at in the Catskill region. And then I'm not sure where the Southern Tier one is going to go, somewhere in Broome County? Or
well, the district that the Southern Tier is in actually loops up to Lake Ontario. So it actually, there's a small strip of land west of Rochester that's eligible. And so there's a proposal for there. In the capital region, besides the immediate Albany area, the East Greenbush proposal and the Exit 23 of the Thruway proposal, Amsterdam might have a proposal.
Right.
And the most interesting one to me, which is a local effort because it's not being put forward by a casino developer who's looking for a location. It's being put forward by a location looking for a casino developer is Howe Caverns outside of Cobleskill in
Schoharie.
In Schoharie. So I guess a little will happen, but not much is good. I don't think anything has to happen in the legislature before the end of the year. What do you see happening in the legislature in the next 6 weeks? Their target date for recessing is June 19th, so it's a little bit six weeks and a couple days.
Well, so now we're, you know, now that the budget's completed and the legislature just got back from their 1 month recess, it's the 2014 session part two, where they deal with every other piece of legislation beyond the budget. And, you know, Franco mentions they always set a target date for around June 19th. It generally goes into the last week of June, and that's when every other piece of legislation is going to be looked at. So, of course, it's an election year, so people are scrambling to make their mark. There's a lot of jockeying and sort of elbowing around to make political statements through the legislative agenda. And I think there's also a lot of things that didn't get dealt with in the state budget that now people want to take a second swipe at.
From the perspective of labor unions, our co-host Brian McDonald is a legislative and political representative for American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees for their New York chapter. Is there anything the labor community is hoping to see happen before the end of the session?
So we're going to be focusing our efforts on two pieces of, well, several pieces of legislation, but really two big ideas. The first is the Jobs Act, which is basically putting some strings attached to all this economic development aid that goes out to these IDAs and businesses throughout the state. You know, Howie Hawkins mentioned all this corporate welfare. There's more than $7 billion a year that our state spends on what they call economic development. And over the years, it's been layer upon layer upon layer, and none of these programs ever seems to go away, but many of them don't actually create jobs. So what we're looking at is all this money going out the door and very little accountability. So we'd like to see some strings attached to that. We'd like to see some job creation targets put on there, some clawbacks if the companies that say they're going to create jobs don't actually create jobs. So we'd like to put some strings to that. The second piece that we're going to be focusing on is basically the outsourcing of essential public services. So in a time of shrinking revenue, many governments have turned to the private sector to deliver services that were traditionally delivered by the public sector. Unfortunately, what we've seen is these sweetheart deals to these corporations, long-term deals to these corporations. Like, you know, this, a famous example is the city of Chicago outsourced their parking meters to a private company. They got a one shot of revenue, which seemed like a lot of money at the time. But now studies have shown that they're going to lose billions and billions of dollars of revenue, while at the same time, this private company is now charging people $15, $17, $20 an hour to park downtown in Chicago, where it used to cost $7 or $8 an hour. So what we're trying to do is make sure that if these private companies, again, it's similar to the Jobs Act, if these private companies make these promises, then they need to deliver on some of those promises, and that there are clawback provisions if they don't deliver, if they put in a bid for public services and they can't satisfy the conditions of that bid, that there's an opportunity to go back and take the bid away from them.
The Fiscal Policy Institute, where I had been the executive director, maybe 5 or 6 years ago, we did a report called Privatization Without Competition Means Huge Losses. Mm-hmm. And what the point of the report was is that privatization sounds attractive because it sounds like you'll get the benefit of private sector competition. But the problem is with privatization in the form of outsourcing, of contracting out, you don't get the benefit of competition, because you, in effect, give a monopoly, such as the Chicago parking meters, to a private company. So the most attractive thing about privatization for people who believe in the free market is the name, because they don't actually get free market competition.
Right. So what you lose...
More like corporatization.
That's right. What you lose with privatization and what we're now referring to as outsourcing is you lose all public oversight, because once these contracts are awarded, a lot of times... Actually, written into the contract is a percentage of profits, right? So if you look at some, the more deeply you look into these contracts, the more frightening it really is. So there's guaranteed profits for these corporations. There's a lack of oversight and accounting and auditing functions that the public sector would normally provide for these services. And at the same time, you're also driving the wages down, because for these corporations, the profits are all, it's all about the bottom line. So what were once public services that the public cares about and really depends upon, now you've got a private sector contractor trying to squeeze for every last dollar.
Right. So as Frank pointed out, with 6 weeks or so left in the legislative session here, it seems like everything gets done at the last minute. All the big issues get wrapped up at the end and all get thrown into a new big ugly, if you will. But I guess I want to go back a little bit to the jobs bill. I mean, I
what does that acronym stand for?
I do. I can't remember.
It's J-O-B-S. It's an acronym.
It's a great acronym.
The main organization doing the staff work on it is Align New York. So if you want to look at the information about the Jobs Act or the actual bill itself, it's AlignNY.org.
Right. And what amazes me, I mean, it's such a common sense type of bill, right, where it just asks for some accountability and transparency for these billions of dollars that we're shoving out the door each year in the name of job creation, when in fact these dollars are not creating jobs. So you would think that Governor Cuomo, given his stance on looking and examining any waste in public spending, like in education, in the healthcare system, in our state workforce, he's put that under a microscope as of late. But, when it comes to these business subsidies, for some reason, we just keep handing them out without any accountability. It just makes no sense. It's given the enormity of the money we're doling out.
And you mentioned an important word, right? You mentioned transparency, because a lot of times these contracts are black boxes and there's no oversight. And there's no sort of even keeping track of what happens. So the money goes out, the contract is written and received, but there's no transparency at all. So you're right. This really is a common sense piece of legislation.
Yeah. So right now it's introduced by Assemblyman Ryan from Buffalo. and Senator Savino.
Sean Ryan.
Right.
Senator Diane Savino, both of whom we've had as guests here on the People's Business. And I should mention that we now have a technological advance for the People's Business. That our co-host Ron Deutsch from New Yorkers Fiscal Fairness has posted the audios in MP3 form for the People's Business programs going back to last September on his website, abetterchoiceforny.org.
Yep. Just look for the WRPI logo right on the home screen, and you can click on it, and you can listen to past episodes of the People's Business if you like. And that site will be updated on a more regular basis, and there'll be more details emerging as we build it out.
To help us to dig into the major challenges and opportunities facing New York State, we're now pleased to be joined on the telephone by businessman, high-tech entrepreneur, innovative political thinker, and activist Bill Samuels. Bill, thank you very much for taking time out of your schedule to meet with us this morning.
Well, it's a pleasure. Thank you.
How you doing, Bill? Welcome to the People's Business here on WRPI in Troy.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Well, we're very happy to have you on today. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your work that you've been doing. You've been involved in New York State politics for some time now. Looking at your New Roosevelt website, which says New Roosevelt is not necessarily a formal organization, but the brand created by activist Bill Samuels to spur change in New York State legislature, to make New York State's legislature the best in the nation. Wanted to ask you, how's that effort going so far, Bill? Are you feeling like we've got the best legislature in the nation right now?
No, but I believe we can have the best legislature with the leadership. Unfortunately, Governor Cuomo has been just a huge disappointment. The fact is, you cannot pass progressive legislation, whether it's the DREAM Act or small donor financing, without electing a Democratic state Senate. That's very clear. And he's made no effort, whether in 2010 or 12, to have us win the state Senate so we can pass progressive legislation. He's got to step up, and if he doesn't, the struggle then has to continue.
This is Brian McDonald, and I'd also like to welcome our guest, Bill Samuels, to the People's Business here on WRPI Troy. Besides New Roosevelt, you're also involved in an advocacy effort called Effective New York. Bill, can you tell us a little bit about Effective New York and some of the reforms that you're pushing forth?
Sure. Effective New York is a good government group, like Common Cause. We have a C3 and C4. Our focus is on identifying innovative legislation that can move the state forward, and then taking a very aggressive stance by traveling around the state, meeting with editorial boards and the press to drum up support for change in New York.
So, Bill, I wanted to ask you, toward that end, I know you've advanced some significant policy positions on reforming kind of the state-local relationship that New York has. You've pointed out that New York is one of the few states in the nation that actually pass along Medicaid costs down to the county level. And I know you've made some proposals that would change that dynamic. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, look, Medicaid is one of our most important social programs, and even more important given Obamacare. However, the way the legislature, and in particular Governor Cuomo, are financing it is nothing but bizarre. 26 states in our nation, after the federal government pays its share, the state pays 100% of the balance. In 23 states, small administration costs are passed along, the highest being California at $1 billion. Governor Cuomo is saddling the counties in New York City with $8.4 billion. It's unheard of. We're the only state that does it. As a result, when Governor Cuomo says he's done more than any other governor in recent history to lower property taxes, it's an outright lie. if you go to Western New York, as I did yesterday in Rochester, and I met with Maggie Brooks, the county leader. I met with Lovely Warren, our new mayor. Both of them said it's unconscionable that this isn't right. And being a Western New Yorker, we have the highest property taxes in the country. We need to do what every other state does. Tell the voters the truth, because most voters don't understand that we're the only state that does this, and free up our counties and mayors from this tax burden where the responsibility should be at the state.
So, Bill, we talk a lot about property taxes on this show. One of the things we've spoken about in the past was how every year the governor talks about how high property taxes are, and he always comes up with a solution for the problem, but it never seems to work. So the first year he was elected, he said we need to cap property taxes, and he put in his 2% property tax cap. The year after that, he talked about reducing pensions for public employees. Last year, he talked about doing away with binding arbitration for law enforcement. This year, he talked about forced consolidation of local government. What you're saying, it sounds like, is that there's an $8.3 billion solution to the property tax problem, but it's having the state take over Medicaid costs.
Exactly right. And let me tell you the significance of that. He talks about a 2% property tax freeze. If the state does what 49 other states does, and if the governor steps up and tells the people the problem because they don't understand it, the county property tax reduction on average across our counties is 49.1%. It's not a minor change. It's just, you look at that and you realize how shocking it is. Leadership, which he's not leading, requires him to attack property taxes, which cause us not to be competitive from Nassau County to Onondaga County in recruiting business, and tell people the truth and have the courage to do what 49 other states do.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we're speaking with Bill Samuels of New Roosevelt and Effective New York. You can learn more about Bill and the issues he's working on by the websites for those two entities, newroosevelt.com and effectiveny.org. Bill, you were just talking about the governor telling the truth about property taxes. I think what an interesting phenomena is how the governor has actually been successful in making it sound to voters that high property taxes are local government's fault, when really the state determines the division of labor between state and local, what services local governments are going to have to pay for, what revenues they have available, and what aid the state provides. And the governor has been able to maintain this campaign for almost 4 years without ever acknowledging that one of the causes for increasing property taxes is reductions in state aid.
Absolutely. You couldn't have said it better. I have nothing to add.
But how has the governor been so successful in shaping the message that he's able to totally avoid any recognition of the state's responsibility?
Well, you know, that's a good question. And you can add to that the ridiculous constitutional amendment on redistricting. You can add the lack of kickback on how he set up the Ethics Commission. These issues are complex. You cannot expect the average voter to understand them unless, one, you have a governor with vision who goes out on the road and educates people. Two, when the governor doesn't do that, we're left with no choice. People tend to fear Governor Cuomo, not admire him. It's time that we stand up. I'm calling on the governor to do a number of things. One, to support every single state Democratic state senator so that we can pass legislation. Two, since we can't get Klein and the IDC to rejoin the conference, he should tell Klein that he no longer will attend any leadership meetings. That will send a strong signal to Jeff, who loves being in the mix. But three, the governor has to, if he doesn't stand up, the Working Families Party, I hope, appoints or elects someone to run against him. So at least we send a message that we've had it. We've had it on property taxes. We've had it on the DREAM Act, et cetera.
In terms of public education, I don't think it's a problem that the governor isn't educating the public. I think that he's very effectively educating them, but he's, in effect, miseducating them.
Right.
He's an effective educator.
Effective miseducator.
Well, you know what? That's just unfortunate. This state is ready to really take a leadership role in the nation again. We have so many incredible people. I met with a group called Metro Justice night, I guess it was last night or the night before in Rochester. God, you ought to have seen the young and old people all in a room. All we're lacking is leadership. I'm actually optimistic. I think our legislature has gotten a lot better. We have a lot of new elected officials, but there's also an enormous number of people that would run for the legislature if they felt they could make a difference. So we just got to continue the fight, that's all.
So I wanted to ask you along those lines, and you brought up a challenge to the governor from the left. I think you've certainly been a frequent critic of the governor and saying he's far too conservative for a Democrat. I obviously have been a critic as well, as many others have. It doesn't seem to be a lot of folks out there necessarily criticizing him. But I have to say, I mean, I think the recent Siena College poll, which looked at, the governor's reelection bid and what would happen if there was an unnamed third-party candidate running on the left, and it dramatically reduced the governor's victory over Rob Astorino, really almost cut it in half. Is that something that you find encouraging? I know it's something that I looked at and was pretty shocked by. And do you think, a group like the Working Families Party will, in fact, endorse a candidate other than Governor Cuomo?
Well, first, let me say, I really admire the work that Citizen Action and the Working Families Party have done. I leave that decision to them. They certainly, I would say, would like to put up an opponent. Money is an issue. They have certain loyalty to groups that have funded them right from the beginning. And I've said I would like them to put up a candidate, but if they don't, I still admire their work. But it comes back to money. Governor Cuomo accepted $87,000 from David Koch. He's accepted 1,881 corporate donations. So when you look at his war chest, and you look at that poll doesn't put into the equation that even if we nominate our own candidate, it's going to have to be a movement on the ground and a social media campaign because no one has the money to go up against Cuomo. And that's the shame of where we are.
Bill, in 2010, you ran for lieutenant governor. There was a good chance for a while that you may have been the governor's running mate. So I think there was an impression that you were supporting his agenda in 2010. How did you get to the place where now, 4 years later, you're such a vocal critic of the governor?
Well, that's absolutely correct. I supported Governor Cuomo in 2002. When he announced with his thick book of policy, I was enthused. You may or may not remember, my father ran for governor in 74 and picked Mario as his lieutenant governor. I was enthused. And to put it in summary, I told the Cuomo people over a series of six meetings that I was going to run independent of Andrew because we needed to reform our own Democratic Party and win the state Senate. They gave me a commitment that if I took on, which I had committed to do, Pedro Espada, and made that the center of my campaign, they would put up over $1 million to run four state Senate races to ensure, independent of Sampson and Smith, to ensure we reformed our own party. After he won the primary, the fact is he reneged on his promise that he made to me and to many others. And that's just Governor Cuomo. You can't rely on what he says. you got to look at what he does. It's a bad situation, but those are the facts. That's what happened in 2010.
So then what's your political future?
Well, I love what I'm doing in good government. I love thinking and advocating, new policies. So at minimum, I'm going to go around the state. So I said I was in Rochester this week. I've been in Syracuse on the same meetings. And educate. And to the extent that makes a small contribution to change, I'm happy. I've never been one to focus personally on elective office. That's not necessarily in my plans. And, I'll do my part, and you guys do your part, and maybe someday we'll get to where we have nothing to do.
We live for that day, Bill.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, too. I mean, along those lines, you were talking about the amount of money that Cuomo's raising from big money donors, and it is pretty astounding. I mean, the majority of the money that he's raising are from big corporate interests, largely from New York City, doing the LLC bundling and all sorts of other kind of things to kind of skirt campaign finance law while still staying within what's legal, not necessarily what's moral. But what I find troubling is that this is a governor who's out there continuing to talk about the virtues of public financing, about the need for matching funds for small donations, yet less than 1% of his political campaign contributions come from people donating $1,000 or less. So it seems like, the folks that are donating $50 or $100 make up, the tiniest fraction of Governor Cuomo's campaign war chest. So, do you think that's a bit hypocritical of the governor to be out there and talking about these issues while raising money like that?
Not a bit hypocritical. It's totally hypocritical. We have an old culture governor who grew up in Albany. It's his 20th year, if you count his 12 years under his father. He has no interest in reform. He mouths that because he believes that will pacify the left, and it has for a while. But it's even worse than you think. I recently sent a letter to Preet Bharara, asking him to investigate the following. When you break down the 1,881 donors and you subtract the big corporate names that we know and the big real estate firms and Donald Trump and David Koch, what you see is shocking. He has called across the board all these small contractors, all the electrical companies, the paving companies, the cement companies, taxi and limo companies, the number of suppliers to the state that have been called I've never seen it before. And I was finance chair for the Democratic State Senate we won in 08. And sure, you do the pay-to-play and the labor unions, but I've never seen the number of small contractors. It's a story that hasn't been told, and it's very worrisome to me. Now, without digging in and actually calling those contractors and seeing what percent do business for the state, which takes an investigation, but this is a cynical pattern by the governor, and he says, and he's correct, these aren't loopholes. It's the law. I mean, is that the type of inspiring leadership we want in this state? I mean, it's really wrong. And the question is whether we march on Albany and force a change. That's why my advice to the Working Families Party and others, you got to break with them. To suck up to him and because you want a seat at the table, it doesn't work. He is who he is. You got to break with him. You got to have him have fear from the left and work and have concrete steps to bring us back in the fold. I will vote for ever who the Working Families Party candidate is, if they choose to go in that direction.
You're describing the pay-to-play culture that exists in Albany that this governor has perfected. You're talking about some pretty significant reform there, Bill.
Yep. But you know what? If you go back in history, in 1956, L.E. Stevenson said something really profound. and I don't know how to solve it. He said, the day that comes that we merchandise candidates like we do cereal is the day that we've lost all dignity in the electoral process. We need sweeping new change in how we think about it, and small donors is just part of it. But I, for one, and I'm sure I'm not the only one, one reason I'm averse to ever being a candidate is who wants to spend all your time, instead of thinking about issues, making these stupid phone calls. So we're going to need some innovative thoughts. One I have, and I don't know how feasible it is, cable companies get licenses from the city, from New York City, et cetera. We need to call on our cities not to renew those licenses unless they do something to give a lot more free airtime, and the FCC needs to do the same. I don't know the solution. I just know that the cynicism that it builds in the public is huge. Let me give you one statistic. In 1970, which was the first primary we had for governor in this state.
What was the year again?
1970.
Okay.
We had conventions before that. 92% of the people in New York could vote. 8% were independent, and in New York, you can't vote unless you're registered in your party. Today, about 30% are independent. Why is that? Why that great growth? It's because, basically, these TV commercials, while effective, alienate people. Mm-hmm. And more people just say, I'm just for the best man. Now, what happens is when 30% of the people that can't vote, and that they tend to be in the middle, it caused divisiveness. You know, it killed the Republican Party. Before, with primaries, we had Javits, Rockefeller, Levitz, Goodell, et cetera. So there's a whole host of reforms, of which some new type of regulation of TV advertising that are necessary if we're going to make the word politician respectable. I happen to admire anyone who goes into public service and dedicates their life to it. It's a tough career. But I'll tell you what, this fight, while winnable, isn't winnable unless, one, Governor Cuomo is ousted, which we don't think is going to happen, or we force him to think in the way that we're all discussing on this radio show.
I think that's a good note to finish up on. Very well said and very philosophical. This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, and we've been speaking with businessman, high-tech entrepreneur, innovative political thinker, and activist Bill Samuels. You can learn more about Bill and his organizational and issue efforts at newroosevelt.com and effectiveny.org. Bill, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
My pleasure.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you, Bill.
Bye.
This is The People's Business on WRPI Troy, a production of the Fiscal Policy Institute and WRPI's Public Affairs Committee. And we're a part of WRPI's regular Tuesday morning feature, Capital District Progressive Radio. I'm Frank Morrow, Executive Director of the Fiscal Policy Institute, and I'm joined here in the WRPI studio by Brian McDonald, AFSCME New York's Legislative and Political Director, and Ron Deutsch, Executive Director of New Yorkers Fiscal Fairness. Please join us again on Tuesday, June 2nd. And now, stay tuned for Democracy Now!